So, good evening to all of you, and welcome to this really nice little center that you have here. In terms of your experience, do you have much experience with Buddhism and all the technical terms, or shall I keep technical terms to a minimum? Keep it to a minimum, eh?
Yes. Well, do you
want to
use the technical terms but explain?
Okay.
We can educate ourselves.
Okay. So, very often in Thailand, we have various different projects and ways of talking about Dharma. And one of the things I like to do is, because for regular Buddhists, we get a bit bored with the regular teachings. And to get people to come out, you have to jazz things up a little bit. So I tend to do topics which cover Buddhism and other things. So this particular topic, the spirituality of imperfection, this was a topic that I did about 4 or 5 years ago, and this was with the 12-step program. Do you know the 12-step program? This is the AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous are really quite a wonderful group and quite a wonderful structure. They have no central organization. They're very, very organic. And obviously it's there to help people overcome addiction to mostly alcohol, but also drugs and other addictive things. And they start from a very interesting statement. They start from the presumption or the statement that they are powerless to overcome their addiction. That's very interesting for a group that is trying to stop people from drinking. There's a lot of God talk in the 12 steps. 12 steps are the 12 layers of things that you go through so that you become what they call a sober alcoholic, which means you know you're an alcoholic, but you remain sober from it. And I found this concept very useful myself. I myself got into meditation at quite a young age, but through depression. And just like the AA people are sober alcoholics, I'm a happy depressive. Because you recognize that there is a part of your character that is very powerful and very strong. And the more you fight it, the stronger it becomes. I'm very fond of stories and storytelling. And maybe next time I come, I can do a course of stories here.
Good.
I'd really like to do that. And I just did one in Singapore on the Journey to the West, if you know that one. Very often in stories, you have a theme, they're called motifs, and a theme of two equal warriors fighting each other. The ones that spring to mind right now, because I'm doing Greek mythology, is Hector and Achilles. And both of these were equal, great warriors, and they were totally equal in strength. And whatever each one of them attempted to do to the other, they could use an equal amount of power to overcome it. So between Achilles and Hector, neither could get the upper hand. And the only way that Hector finally managed to win, even though they were equal in strength, Achilles was immortal. That is, he couldn't be harmed. It's kind of cheating, right? And this is because his mother had taken Achilles and dipped him in the river Styx. And the river Styx is the divider between the earth and the underworld. And if you dip a baby in the river Styx, they become unassailable. So their body becomes unharmable. But where she held him, she held the baby by the ankle, you see, by the heel of the foot. It's actually the heel. And dipped him in the river Styx. So he was vulnerable at that point where his mother had held the baby's foot. And that's where we get the phrase Achilles' heel, which means your weak spot. So this theme is very common in stories throughout the world, and of two equals fighting each other. And the meaning behind this story is that your problems that come up are you fighting yourself. So the stronger you get, the stronger, the harder the fight becomes, because it's you yourself that you're fighting against. So the AA have this idea. They start with the statement, you are powerless to overcome your addiction, because the part of you that is fighting is you yourself. You're fighting against yourself. And as human beings, we try our best to integrate our psyche into one being, one person, one set of moral conduct, set of ideas. But actually, you can't do it, because you're not one person. You are various numbers of people. So, for example, with the alcoholics, an alcoholic knows that they are killing themselves and that they are dying. And you would think, for most of us, if we know that we're dying of something, we're going to change it, right? If you know that eating French fries every day is going to give you a heart attack and kill you, if you are a reasonably intelligent human being, you're going to stop eating so many French fries. But there is another side to the alcoholics, and that is the side that just wants to drink. So, when it comes to giving up alcohol, they are fighting against themselves. So their psyche is split and is fighting itself to try and overcome the addiction. Is this only true of alcoholics? No, it's true for all of us. And throughout literature, you have this kind of theme until Shakespeare. Shakespeare ruined everything, in my opinion, with literature. Sorry, but... Because before Shakespeare, stories were followed a format of storytelling, and storytelling spoke about the psyche. And Shakespeare spoke about people. So he ruined it all. So stories were really demonstrations of the battles that go on within you. And for many thousands of years, this is how human beings have understood themselves. Shakespeare ruined it, and then Freud actually reintroduced the idea. And he started to recognize that you are not one single psyche, but you are a number of warring what he called drives. So, to give you a concrete example, Freud's had this little format. It was called the id, the ego, and the superego. And this is classical psychology. And the id is the part of you that wants to get what it likes. And your ego is the part of you that wants to get what is good for you. So the word ego in common English language is not correct in psychology. In common English, ego means I want to make myself bigger and better and smarter and more beautiful than other people. So I want to put other people down and I want to make myself bigger. That's the usual interpretation of the term ego. But in Freudian psychology, that was not true. He said that when you are very young, like this guy, girl. Well, they're all guys. Aren't girls guys, right? Can't you say that? Yeah, you say guys. Is only interested in what she wants, right? She doesn't care what's good for her. She doesn't care about her future. She doesn't care about her past. She wants to either feed, take stuff in, poop it out, or sleep, basically. Is there anything else? That's it, basically. Little machine to... And so that's the id. Animal just wants to likes certain things and dislikes other things. But as you grow up, Freud said that you start to learn that there are rules to society, and primarily in your own home originally. And as you get older, when you're this age, anything you want your mum gets for you, or does her best, right? But when the child gets to like 6 years old, maybe less, 5 years old, 6 years old, the parents start making rules. And the baby wants to poop. That's it. But as you get to 5, 6 years old, like, no, now you're not allowed to just poop anywhere. You have to go to the bathroom, and that's the rule. Right now, the baby just wants to eat and gets food, but 5 or 6 years old, you say, no, you eat when I decide that I feed you, not just because you want it. Baby wants attention. When it's a baby, it gets attention. From 5 or 6, no longer. You get attention when your mum decides you get attention and not at any other time. Now, to a child, this is very traumatic because you've changed the rules on how to bring up a baby, right? The baby had a set of rules which was great. Anything I want, I scream and you bring it. Good system. But now the child knows that they have to change the rules. Think the way the world works has changed. And this is very traumatic for children. And they literally see two mums. One mum is the mum that gives you what you want. And the other mother is the one that's really a little bit harsh and tells you to get lost and doesn't give you what you want. So this is what stories are designed to help with, and this is where you get fairy tales. Now, I presume you've all seen Harry Potter, right? Have you seen Harry Potter? Did you see Harry Potter? Good. You read the books? No.
No, I don't like it.
I don't like it either, but... And in Harry Potter, they fly around on the broomsticks and they have a game of hockey in the air, flying around on broomsticks. Where does this idea come from? Well, to a child, it's absolutely crystal clear. Because you have these two mums. When you...
This is playground.
If you take your self back over 100 years, the primary caretaker would be the mother, not the father. And the times when your mother doesn't want to know you is the time when your mum is cleaning up. So if you imagine your mum sweeping up the house and you're a young child and you go to your mum for attention or feeding or whatever, and your mum says, "Get lost, I'm cleaning up the house." And she's sweeping up, and as she's sweeping the house, she's dashing around quite fast. And the child doesn't understand why she's dashing around with this broom and why she's being so nasty. And that's where you get this whole story about witches flying on broomsticks and the witches being the evil characters. And at the same time in fairy tales, you get the fairy godmother, right, that appears and like magic gives you everything you want and solves all your problems. So these strange fairy tales that you get from Europe of witches and fairy godmothers, they make absolute perfect sense for children psychologically. And this is why fairy tales were, they appear to be very, very weird and odd and gruesome to adults. And then so people come along and they rewrite the fairy tales into little moral tales. Madonna didn't like to tell her kids fairy tales, so she rewrote stories. And they're just silly little stories about a train or an aeroplane, and they don't have any psychological value. So the child learns that there are rules to society, and this is the development of the ego. And where the id is governed by the pleasure principle, the child wants to get what it likes. The ego is driven by the rational principle or the wisdom principle. And the child starts to learn that if you're going to be happy in this world, you need to do what's right and not what you like. So that's the development of the ego. The id and the ego then, they come into clash. These are two parts of your psyche and they fight with each other. Remember this theme of you fighting with yourself? And so for an alcoholic, for example, their id wants to get alcohol, but their ego says that's not a good thing to do. And they have this immense battle and an immense struggle within their psyche. Can we prove this? Yes. You can see this was demonstrated on a test called the marshmallow test. Have you seen that? Anybody else seen that? The marshmallow test, you take a young child and you put them in a blank room, so there's no other entertainment, and you put a single marshmallow, which is a soft candy sweet, and you say to the child, if you want to eat that marshmallow, go ahead. But if you don't eat the marshmallow, I'm going to leave the room, and when I come back, you get two marshmallows, right? Then the adults leave the room and leave the kid, nothing in the room except a table, a marshmallow, and that's it. And they've got to like sit and look at this marshmallow and then decide if they're going to eat it or not eat it. And you can see, you look on YouTube, marshmallow test, there's hundreds of these, very funny. So you can see on the child, it's like, yeah, And then they'll look around the room, something else to do, and then they look at it and they'll pick it up, and then they'll smell it. Sometimes they stick it in their ear, because they want to put it in their mouth, right? And they can't, so they put it in their ear instead. And then this one young boy, you know, the parent left the room, and as soon as the parent left the room, went like this. And pulled this thing out. Another, this young girl, she hollowed it out from the inside, so she ate all the inside but left the cover on. Great fun. So you look at this video and you can see the id and the ego fighting with each other. And you like to think of yourself as a single human being, as a whole person. But actually you're not. You are a war of different drives that fight for attention and fight for supremacy within you. So this battle you can see very clearly on the marshmallow test. And interestingly, if you test 5-year-old children with this marshmallow test, the longer they can sit and not eat the marshmallow, the more successful they will be in their life in terms of education, in terms of career, and in terms of a stable and happy marriage. So if your child fails the marshmallow test, be prepared. You're going to you've got Stormy. No, obviously, this is statistics.
She's bargaining with you already.
So statistically, your child will not be successful in later life, but it's only statistics. It doesn't mean that you can't turn it around. It doesn't mean that you can change, you know, that on an individual basis. So I wouldn't worry too much individually, but we can in fact predict the life course of people by how well they perform at 5 years old with the marshmallow test. So there are all these different warring factions within the psyche that make it very difficult to be a whole or a consistent human being. And Freud said that this is the psyche. Freud wanted to understand what is a human being and why do we behave the way we behave. And this was his first attempt at really explaining that. And he came up with a number of different drives. So there is the id drive, the pleasure drive. There is the ego, the rational principle. There were other drives too. The sex drive is very powerful for human beings. Most interestingly, later on in his life, he was dying of oral cancer, mouth cancer, because he was a lifelong cocaine addict and he would put cocaine in on his gums. And so it's quite fitting in a way that when he died at a good age, it was from oral cancer. Even at this time, he didn't stop trying to figure out how human beings work. And he came up with a very interesting addition to his theory, and he called it the Nirvana drive. Nirvana being the goal of enlightenment. He, like many Germans, understood Nirvana to mean destruction, to completely destroy yourself. That's not a interpretation most Buddhists would agree with today, but that's how the Germans understood it. And being Germans, they really liked this idea. It's nothing so strange as a German. They loved the idea that you keep getting reborn, but if you get enlightened, you have destroyed yourself and obliterated and you're dead. And they really like this idea. Wagner and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, they like this idea. So he came up with this nirvana drive, one of the many drives that fight in your psyche. And this nirvana drive was that at the end of your life, there is an attraction to dying. And this is a very interesting idea. He said, one part of you really wishes to just cease. And he said, even the people that feed their pleasures and are very pleasure orientated, really, pleasure is a disturbance, or wanting is a disturbance. And when you get what you want, you're trying to wipe out that disturbance. In psychology, it's called motivation. Some years ago, I was misdiagnosed with cancer. And it's a long story. I'm perfectly all right. But the doctor told me that I had lymphatic cancer. I later found out it wasn't really a doctor. It was like a... The story went on. It was a doctor. The place was actually an abortion clinic. And I didn't know, because it just had a green cross on. So I walked in thinking it's a hospital. But it's where the locals know that they go for abortions and hysterectomies and women's kind of things. And I should have known, because when I went in, there's like this row of young girls and things, and I should have realized. And then they told me I had lymphatic cancer, which I didn't have. And then he said it was my teeth, and then he said it was TB, and then he said it was nothing at all. And it went on for a number of months. Eventually I was in another hospital, and this doctor said, just forget about it. So that was the last. I took that advice as the best. I just forgot about it. But at that time, I was 35, I think, and I thought that was it. I thought if I did have that kind of cancer, I would have a lifespan of probably 3 to 5 years. And there was an immense relief in amongst the fear and all the other mix of emotions. Incredible mindfulness arises when you realize that you're going to die. It's quite interesting. And all the people who work with dying patients in hospitals report this, that when you know that you're dying, your mindfulness gets so strong, your meditation gets so pure and serene and consistent through the day. Because you're less interested in the stories of things that you want to get or have. So I really felt there was this nirvana principle. There's part of me that was just so relieved in a nice way, in a good way. So you have all of these different things that are fighting in your psyche. Now, when it comes to Buddhism, when it comes to the practice and meditation, very often people approach it from a very fundamentalist attitude and feel that, for example, monks should be incredibly holy and well-behaved. And I thought this too, and then I went and ordained in Thailand, and I found out the monks are not very holy and not very well behaved. And for a long while, this really troubled me. And I must say, I'm not the holiest or best behaved person myself, but of course, I can make excuses for myself. We had this one tradition in our temple. We have alms round in the morning, but my temple is quite... There's only a couple of small villages. And my abbot was a very well-known meditation master, and we had maybe 80 monks. So too many to go out into these villages. So we went out, 8 monks every morning would go on alms round, and we'd meet at the front gate, and there were 4 routes, so 2 monks on each route to go on the alms round. And the Thai monks hated it. They love the tradition, they love the idea, but they don't want to go and do it. You walk barefoot, and the road is quite gravelly, there's no tarmac, and you know, it's quite hard on the feet. Sometimes you get bitten by the dogs as you come through. I'll tell you a weird fact. Every house that I would go to where the people would put food in the bowls, never got a vicious dog. And the only times we got bitten by dogs were houses where you never saw the people come and put food in the bowl. Now, it's correlational science. But there is something beautiful about this tradition in Thailand where people come out in the morning and wait for the monks and put food into the monks' bowls. Their houses are nicer, their children are nicer, and their dogs are nicer. And the monks didn't like to go on these alms rounds. And we had a rota, and the list was put up on who had to go on which days. And normally you did it for 4 days. So one day on each of the routes, 4 days a month. And so the other monks often wouldn't turn up. And this just made me so mad that people would prepare food and sit outside their house to put food in the monks' bowls, and the monks didn't turn up. And I would go stomping off, like really angry. I'd be waiting and then they wouldn't turn up. And then I'd go stomping off, kind of angry, and criticizing these other monks. And some days a lot of them didn't turn up. And I would walk 2 of the alms round routes on my own instead of 4 of us doing the 2 routes. But I could recognize in my mind also what's really going on. On the one hand is the organization of the temple and the people on the streets. But on the other hand is my mind that's getting into a lot of anger and a lot of hatred. My mind is becoming a very unpleasant place to be because I'm criticizing those other monks. And I'm putting them down. The whole walk day, they don't turn up. Why do they not turn up? These people are waiting. They don't come. They don't care about. They just get their food in the temple. And blah, 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 blah. And I could see this going on. And I know that's not any good either. You might not turn up on the alms round because you didn't get up in time, or your feet are too sensitive, or you know, you're worried about the dogs. Actually, as you get more senior, the dogs always attack the person at the back. So as you get more senior, you get more safe. So I had this war in my head. On the one hand, I think the monks are not behaving properly. And on the other hand, I can see I'm not behaving properly either. And every once in a while, the war would just stop. And you're like, and then I look around, and there's this beautiful red, the dirt was red road, and as you go down the road, the sun is right in front, this red sun shining along this red road with these nice people coming out, putting food in the bowl, white rice, but you know. And hey, it's beautiful. It's nice and cool in the morning, I'm out having a nice walk. Why do I carry all this stuff around in my head? The person that I'm fighting against is me, myself. Really, the wars that are going on, it's not about the monks. If all the monks were perfect and acted the way I think they should act, would I be better off, really? just find something else to complain about. And when you look at other people, you're always going to find problems in their behaviour. So I had fallen into the classic error of expecting the monks in the temple to be holy angels. And they're not, they're regular people. I'm not a holy angel either, but you know, I can overlook that. Other people's faults I can see, but mine, you know, just I've got good excuses for. So this idea of the AA that they have is, to me, to my mind, quite a beautiful idea. And they call this the spirituality of imperfection, which was the title. I don't know who picked the title for this talk. I mean, I got lots of talks, but this is where the title of this talk comes from. Because when you go into the AA, you start from this recognition that not only are you not perfect, but you're also powerless to overpower yourself. You can't do it. There has to be some other way, some other means that you can do that. As you get more mature with the meditation, you start to learn to accept other people more the way that they are. There was a person I met in England, and he became a Buddhist and a meditator. And I asked him, what is it that drew you to become a meditator? And he said that he'd been in Thailand, and there was one thing that really impressed him. And due to this one thing, he decided to become a Buddhist and to do meditation. What's that one thing? You've got to ask, right? He said he'd gone to a temple and he was taking some photographs. And there were two monks there in the morning. They were doing the morning chanting. And as they were doing the chanting, this enormous spider comes down from the roof, comes down on a web right above the head of the monk, one of the monks. And fortunately, the other monk spotted it and gave him a tap, and like this. There's this hand-sized spider descending onto your head. And the monk looked up, acknowledged it, got up on his knees, moved 5 paces to the right, sat down and carried on with his chanting. And this was so mindful and so peaceful and so beautiful that it inspired that English man to take up Buddhism and meditation. Do you know when you blow a balloon up and then you let it go and it kind of all over the room, bouncing off the walls and the ceilings? Yeah? That's me when I see a spider. If that spider had been coming down on me on that particular day, that man would never have become a Buddhist. But nonetheless, I think I'm a good monk and I do my practice and I do my part. And the point of the story is that by looking at the behavior of other people, you can't really judge. You have to learn to let people be as they are. To let the monk who is very peaceful with the spider do that, and the one who is very agitated with the spider. I noticed that the Thai monks get very fearful of snakes. And you're not supposed to kill animals, but they draw the line at snakes. Me, I'm fine with snakes. With snakes, you just offer a bit of loving kindness and, you know, all right, Mr. Snake, you go that way, I go this way, and we have a deal, right? But But the Thai monks, they can't take the snakes. Very often, you know, people come into the temple and they have this grand view of exactly what monks should be like, how they should behave, what Buddhists should be like, what a meditator should be like. And starting the practice and the religion with this viewpoint of perfection, this is how things should be, this is how people should be. And inevitably, when you do that, in your psychology, you're going to have a view, this is how I should be also. And as we've seen already, you are not an I, you are not a single person. You are a mass of warring drives. And the part of you that says, I'm going to be holy, I'm going to be a meditator, I'm going to sit for 1 hour every day in the morning, I'm going to be so patient, that's only one side of you. And the stronger that you try and make that side to be, the more the other side of you is going to fight against it. So I see a lot of people come and ordain as monks, and they have a lot of expectations, both of the other monks of the temple and expectations of themselves. When they come in, you see these kind of people who ordain, and they seem very devout and very pious and very determined, and they sit like this in the meditation, and you can almost hear the clock ticking, you know, like how long are they going to last? Because they're starting from the wrong point. They're starting from a religion of perfection. And this is what the statement of the AA was trying to say doesn't work. If you're starting from a point of view of perfection, and this is how things should be, this is how I should be, this is how I want to be, what you've done is you've set up an immense battle within yourself. Hector and Achilles fighting it out with each other. Or Monkey and Pigsy, if you know Journey to the West, fighting it out with each other. Neither of them can get the upper hand. So when you start with the AA, they say the first line that they give you is, you are powerless to overcome your addiction. Isn't that an interesting way to begin the process of giving up the addiction? So what can we do if you are powerless to overcome? There is your faults, because enlightenment is a really immense thing. It's unimaginable. The Buddha talked about meeting gods and goddesses and going down to hell realms and seeing heavens and hells and karma and the way beings are being born and reborn according to their karma. Right? He talked about a detachment so perfect that even if someone was to hack your arm off with a saw, you wouldn't arouse any anger towards that person. It's unimaginable, right? I can't imagine what that must be like. I really can't imagine what enlightenment would be like. And that's a difficult place to then start a religion from, something that you don't understand. And yet, you can still practice and relate to it. For example, I quite like physics. I'm not sure how many of you are into physics, but I was reading about the way an atom is constructed. And in the atom you have a proton, which is a positively charged base. It has a couple of neutrons. We're going to ignore the neutrons for now, but has a positively based core to the atom and a negatively charged electron, and the electron spins around not in a stable orbit, but in every direction it spins around this proton. The proton is 2,000 times larger than the electron. Yeah? So, to imagine how this works, if you imagine putting your foot on a football, if that football was the proton, the electron would be the size of a pea. The green kind, not the yellow kind. Right? And that pea would be about 45 miles away. Can you imagine that? And that's a hydrogen atom. If you go and kick that pea, so it changes from 45 miles to 45 miles less a couple of meters, the charge of that pea and the proton are out of harmony with each other. So the electron will jump back to its original orbit. And when it jumps back, it unloads energy, and that energy is a photon, and that's light. Have I lost you yet? I can't get my head around this. I really tried with physics. I've tried and tried to understand electricity, and I can't. It's unimaginable. And yet, we can relate to light. You know, we can turn on the light switch, we can change our light bulbs from white to warm white, right? We can relate to light very easily, even though we don't understand it. So within Buddhism, we have this goal of enlightenment that's really unimaginable. There are many texts about it. There are a few descriptions of it. For example, one description says, enlightenment is mind without consciousness. Doesn't even sound appealing, does it? You know, well, I want my consciousness, please. Unimaginable. So, if we're starting from this point of the perfection, of the ultimate, you're setting yourself up for conflict. And one of the translations for the word dukkha, which we usually translate as suffering, one translation is conflict. So there needs to be some trick, because it's you fighting against yourself. We have these ideals of what we're trying to attain to, or ideals of practice and meditation or monks. But the reality on the ground is not like that. So, the process that we do as meditators is one of emptying out. It's when this conflict ceases that you start to see Dharma. Now, I have a story about this. It's a very famous story now. And people remember this story, especially women remember this story. But remember, the story is there for a reason. And afterwards, everybody remembers the story, but nobody can remember why I told the story. So I'm going to tell you the story, but I want you to be careful that you remember why I told the story. This is 22 years ago, and I was a layman, and I was working in the south of England, in a place called the English Riviera. And that's in inverted commas because it's just a drizzly, damp, unappealing place like anything in England. I was working there. It's actually a very pretty town. It's called Dartmouth, if anyone's been. Very pretty town. All the buildings are, I can't remember what you call it here, heritage buildings, right? So you can't change the building. So they're all like crooked and the roofs are half collapsed and the doorways are all at funny angles, but nobody can change anything, you see. So it's quite a pretty place. And I was working there. I'd been in the monastery for a year and I'd left and I'd taken a job which I was enjoying as a chef, having no training as a chef, but I got this job And I said, oh, I worked in a hotel once. And I thought, oh, that's close enough. You can work as a... I'm not kidding. A great time I had there. And I was coming to the end of my time working as a chef, and I was trying to decide if I should become a monk. The big stumbling block for me going to Thailand and becoming a monk was the hairdresser. And there's not many people in this little town, so you tend to find out the really pretty girls, you know, you tend to find out where they are. And this one was the hairdresser. And she would sometimes walk down to work on the same walk as I do, so we'd see each other quite often, and we'd exchange a few little hellos and things. And I, to be frank, I thought I was in with a shot. So I had this battle. Do I go to Thailand and become a monk and strive for this impossible thing of enlightenment? Or do I hook up with the hairdresser? And this went on for days and days and days, like, you know, no, I really want, like, enlightenment is like the goal of some monum of humanity, and like, yeah, but she's really cute. and then like, well, maybe I can stay with her for like a couple of years until I get bored or get divorced or something, and then I'll go and become a monk. And this went on for day after day, and just as it's starting to calm down, she kind of walked by and said, good morning. And I went, ah, there she is again. And, yeah. Like, become a monk now, hook up with the hairdresser. And this, right? You should see why I brought this story up. This is a war in my head. And one day I was walking down the street, and then I saw her, and she kind of waved like this, looking very pretty. And it's quite by coincidence that I happened to need a lot of haircuts around that time. And as she waved, then something just snapped in my mind. And this battle of me fighting me. One aspiration, one drive of me fighting against another aspiration and drive for me. And at that second, I realized this is dukkha, this conflict is dukkha. And then that moment, the whole conflict just ceased in my mind. And as I was walking down that street, I heard the seagulls. And the reason I had gone to that pretty little town in the south of England was because they have seagulls, and they have nice little buildings, and they have flowers everywhere outside the window boxes. And they have fish and chips. And and that's what I'd gone there for. That's why I'd gone and taken a job in this strange place, long way away from where I lived. And I looked around, and I'm like, oh yeah. How come every single day I'm walking to work and back and I've got this war going on in my head, when really just like happiness is right there, just around me? So everybody remembers the hairdresser, and years later people are saying, you know, like, you're going to Australia? And I'm like, yeah, I'm going for a month. Like, I hope you don't meet any hairdressers. And everyone remembers the hairdresser, but remember why I told you the story. The point is that this battle that goes on in the mind, if you can find Dharma, you'll never make one side of you bigger and stronger and tougher than the other side of you. Where you find Dharma is where it all stops. And if you can catch that moment where everything stops, you can breathe. Your attention returns to yourself. There's nothing there, it's empty, but it's beautiful and it's present and it's mindful. And that's the key. That's the Achilles heel. That's the little trick that will come about when you can let go of this battle. Because the battle in your head, you can't win. That's why in the AA, their first statement they make, you are powerless to overcome your addiction. Fighting against yourself is not going to be the path. They say, this is the spirituality of imperfection. If you go to a church, they talk about God, and they talk about the Heavenly Father. Jesus says to you, you should be perfect even as your Heavenly Father is perfect. That's quite a tall order, right? In the Bible it says you have to be absolutely 100% as perfect as God. Impossible, right? Impossible task. So they say, they call this the spirituality of imperfection because you're starting from this point of, I don't know what God is, I don't know what enlightenment is, I don't understand my own self, and I'm powerless to fight against myself. I'm never going to win by fighting against my own being. So the start of the path in the AA is spirituality of imperfection. I acknowledge that I am powerless. I acknowledge that I am weak. I acknowledge that I'm not perfect. And I'm going to start from that point. My practice and my meditation and my path starts from that point. In all fairy tales and stories, you always start from this point. Called in the theory of storytelling, it's called the impossible task. So remember Jack and the Beanstalk? You all know Jack and the Beanstalk story? No? No. Okay. Write it down next time I come. Jack and the Beanstalk. It's funny, I was in Singapore, which is an odd place. I was trying to get the train and I'd gotten off at the wrong stop and I had to go one stop and I didn't know if it was one stop that way or one stop this way. So I stopped somebody and said, where's Queenstown? Which way is it? And they put their hand in my face like this. So I stopped another person, which way is Queenstown? And they went and walked straight past me. And I asked about 10 people, which way is Queenstown? You know, that's just, I just wanted to know, and they wouldn't even listen to my question. I think they think I'm asking for money or something. I was like, what do you do if you can't ask a human being a human question because I need a little help? What can you do? I'm like, I don't have any processes in my repertoire that I can think of to do. I was just like really stuck with my mouth open, like, what do you do? And then somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, can I help you? And there was this young guy. I said, I just want to know which way to Queenstown. He said, oh, you get this way. That was easy, thank you. And then I kind of looked at him and I said, nobody wants to help me here. And he said, oh, he said, I came to your talk 3 years ago on Jack and the Beanstalk.
Karma works.
I want to come and tell Jack and the Beanstalk here so that if ever I get stuck in Sydney, there's going to be somebody around to help me.
We've got the hairdresser story.
You've got lots of hairdressers here as well, haven't you? Fortunately, I don't need much hairdressing these days. So there is always an impossible task. In Jack and the Beanstalk, in short, there is a young man who sells the family business. It was actually a cow, but he sells it for 5 beans. And his mother gets furious at him because the cow was their only source of food, and now they have nothing but 5 stupid beans. She throws the beans out of the window, and they become a giant tree. And then he climbs up the tree, and when he climbs up the tree, he meets an ogre. And the ogre, if he sees Jack, will eat him instantly. This is an impossible task. How can Jack save his mum, save their house, kill this enormous giant ogre? It's impossible. Snow White, you know Snow White, right? The Wicked Witch has all this power. Snow White has only one thing. She's pretty. That's all she has. But you always know in a fairy tale that the small thing that doesn't seem important to normal people is what is going to save the hero or the heroine. Jack has his five beans. His mother thinks they're so stupid she throws them out the window. But any child listening to that story knows those five beans are what's important. Rapunzel, another fairy tale, she has the long hair. That's all she had. Nothing else. But that long hair is going to save her. So in all of these fairy tales, all of these stories, including religion, including the Bible, and the Old Testament especially, David and Goliath, right? Mm-hmm. How can this young little David guy kill Goliath the giant? So, you start with the impossible task. The impossible task in the terms of the meditation and spirituality is you fighting against yourself. You can't ever win that battle. So, first step, I am powerless to overcome my addiction. Or for our part, I am powerless to take an egotistical control of my being and my psyche and my behavior and determine how I'm going to be and how I'm going to act. From that point of powerlessness, from that point, there is a surrender. And it's the point of surrender that you see this little quality that we call mindfulness. And mindfulness is simply that knowing yourself. Now, for most people, your attention is outside. You know your children. You know what you want. You know what's on TV. What are you watching on TV? Downton Abbey. You know why I really like Downton Abbey? Because every time I met an American, they'd always say, "Oh my God, you sound like someone of Harry Potter." And now they say, "Oh, you sound like someone of Downton Abbey," and I think that's an improvement, right? So people know what they have in the world, and things you have to look after, your business, your children, your future, your pension, your health. You have to look after those things. But there is a point within the psyche where everything stops. And when everything stops, you are left with just this simple observation, observing. And the Buddhist path, the meditation path, is about training that quality of observation. And if you can observe clearly, you will change. In ways that you can't change yourself, in ways that you can't fight against yourself and create a new self, observation will change you for you. And so this is why the Buddha called his path the way of wisdom. Theravada Buddhism was the Vaibhajavadins, they were called, means the way of analysis or the way of wisdom. And the way to arouse wisdom is by observation. And so just that act of observing and of being mindful will start to change you quite naturally. Take, for example, negative qualities like anger. Various people come to the monastery and they say, "I have so much anger, I want to get rid of my anger. I don't have a magic button that you can press and then you've got no more anger." You can't do it. It's impossible, an impossible task. Nobody ever comes to the temple and says, "Oh, Venerable, I've just fallen in love, please help me." You know, it's only when they get very angry or frustrated or ill health, then they want to come and learn meditation. So learn your meditation while you're healthy and while you can, right? Because it will really pay you later. Anger, when you watch anger, if you remember back to the story when I was angry at the monks who would always miss the alms round, when you watch anger itself, you get sick of it. And that's how the process works. That's how wisdom starts to arise. I can't fight against my anger. I'm powerless. But I can watch my anger and I can see when everything just stops in the mind. And I can see my anger is gone. It's not something that lurks inside me. It's not some psychology, the way that psychology works, that you have this anger inside you and you have to deal with it. There's that point where it just has all stopped and it's all gone. So that's the way of wisdom. The second step in the 12-step program is surrender to a greater power than myself. Because you can't do it, but that doesn't mean this impossible task can't be completed. So just like all these heroes of the stories, they have some quality, they're very pretty, or they have long hair, or they have five beans, or they have a sling. David and Goliath, he had a sling. There is this quality that we have that can complete the impossible task, but it's a power that is higher than you are. So you don't have to do the fighting. Your job is to know yourself. The above the gates at the Oracle of Delphi, where the Greeks would go to get their prophecies, and they would go to see the oracle, and she would get the prophecy from the god Apollo and give them the prophecy and tell them what to do. But the instruction as you go into the temple, above the temple gate, know thyself. Know yourself. Like it's saying, don't worry about the prophecy and trying to get supernatural powers. What you need to do is know yourself. She famously said to one king who went to ask her if he should attack the Persians. It was Persians or the Parthians. And he wanted to know if he should attack that empire. And the Delphi said to him, if you cross the border into that empire, a great empire will fall. So he went off to fight them and he got defeated. And of course it was his empire that was going to fall, not the other person. So prophecies were always not very useful. Do you know the story of Alexander when he got the prophecy? Funny story. He wanted to march his army to go off to India. And he wanted to get the prophecy before he went. Alexander the Great was not one that was going to be messed around by some oracle. You know, he needed his prophecy. Now, she would only come out twice a year, and you had to wait for the right time, and she could come out and commune with Apollo. But that didn't fit Alexander the Great's schedule. So he goes along, and he gets her by the scruff of the neck, and he's shoving her down the path to push her to the temple so she can make a prophecy. And as he's shoving her down the path like this, she says to him, boy, there's no stopping you when you're determined, is there? And Alexander said, thank you, that's just the prophecy I was after. And he went off and he did get all the way to India, right? So, to wrap up, the spirituality of imperfection starts off, the first five clauses of the spirituality of imperfection, starting from a point that I am not perfect, I am powerless to overpower my own self. Clause number two, I must surrender to a power that is greater than myself. And in the AA, even though they use the word God, they are very, very clear. This is whatever God that you follow. This is not a Christian God or a Judaic God. It's whatever higher power you have a feeling for and an understanding of. So they're very clear to be non-religious in the AA. The third step then is one turns one's life over to that greater power. The fourth step is to make an inventory of yourself, which means know yourself. And the fifth step was, I am willing to change. So that was how the spirituality of imperfection works. If you're interested, it was a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. It is a book about the 12-step program, which is a way to overcome addictions. So I'm going to stop there. If you have any questions, now would be the time for a question.
If I can start off, Venerable. You were just talking about in the second step, knowing this, and this higher power. In Buddhism, what would be that higher power, higher quality?
Would be enlightenment. It means you know that there is a goal there and that that goal is your destiny. So, yeah, recognizing that there is something that's greater than you is another way to put it.
Okay.
So you can't win this fight within yourself, but you can recognize that there is something greater than myself. And when I get out of the way, that higher power then starts to manifest, is the way that they do it.
Okay.
And I think that relates to us too, because like I say, many people come to the temple and they have very high aspirations and very high expectations. And a big part of learning to be in Thai temples especially is learning to accept that the way that people are and not to be fighting against them and judging them so much. So it's putting aside those, the spirituality of imperfection is juxtaposed against the spirituality of religion. So religion has this, you must be perfect just as God is perfect. Or you must be beautifully behaved monk who has no desires and things, compared to starting from where you actually are at. By the way, this statement of, I don't know if you like Christianity and Christian stuff, but I do. I'm not an expert, but the statement where Jesus says you should be perfect even as your heavenly Father is perfect is the same section where he says God's love shines on the just and the unjust, and God's compassion reigns on the good and the evil equally. So the point is that in God's eyes, just people and unjust people are not in a fight. We're not trying to make all people one way or the other way. For God, God's love shines on everything equally. Therefore, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. So again, you've got this idea that it's not a battle of good against evil or just against the unjust. But there was a funny rebuttal to this statement in the New Testament about God's love that shines on the just and the unjust. You know the word just, it means the fair. Justice comes from the word just. So the just and the unjust means those people who are fair and honest and the people who are not fair and not honest. So there was a poet, might be Ogden Nash. The rain it falleth on the just and the unjust fella, but more it falls on the just, for the unjust stole the just's umbrella. So this was a statement that was arguing against this the New Testament and saying, well, you know, God may love people equally, but for us people on earth, you know, some people get an advantage. Did everything I say make sense? Actually, this topic was something that we did over like 4 days, so you got everything compressed. Actually, it goes on, the 12 steps goes on, and they do a lot of work with forgiveness and asking people who they have hurt for forgiveness. And so the steps go on into a path that they do.
Yeah. When are the steps, the 5 steps you spoke today, where you've taught us those 5 steps, but how do we do it? Like, we know the listing of the 5 steps, and I think, well, for me, it would be the hardest part would be how to do it, how to...
Well, the first part is recognizing that the spiritual path is not about making one side of you stronger than the other side of you. You have a lot of warring desires, right? All these desires that Freud listed, I mean, these are all real. And, you know, you want to look after your daughter, but there's other times when you just wish that your parents would come and take her away for a few days. I mean, and we try to reconcile these things, and this is what literature is about, and novels. They're about trying to give stories that show us reconciling all these different factions of ourselves. And we pretend to be, or we try to be, one consistent person. I saw this Louis C.K. program, and he said to his daughter, he's in the program, he said, "I really don't like you right now." But I thought it's quite a good statement. Louis C.K. is, despite his swearing and racism and all the rest of it, he's a very good observer. And, you know, as a parent, you would say, well, I love my child the whole time. But as an observer, you say, well, I will look after my child in the right way the whole time. But actually, I don't love them the whole time. And when you start to watch this, well, you can either make one side of you stronger than the other, or you can start from accepting that point that you're not perfect and you're powerless to make yourself perfect. In terms of the meditation, the trick is to find that key where everything stops. I never decided to become a monk and not hook up with the hairdresser. What I did was I saw that point where the battle ended. And then I just kind of like woke up, and I could see this town around me and the birds and the flowers. I'm like, oh, that's where it's at.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is a slightly technical thing, so I would normally do this talk for people who have been meditating for a while.
Okay.
But you pick the topic, so...
It's a good topic.
It is a good topic. I like the topic myself. Because I certainly am not a perfect person either. And, you know, I have wars and fights and things going on in my psyche, and I'm just so happy that I don't have to resolve that. I don't have to make myself bigger and stronger and tougher. The whole point of the AA is you give up, you surrender to your imperfections. Then you can start to develop the meditation. Ha, 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 ha.